I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The Senate continues its debate over the energy bill today as more and more people pay attention. Almost everyone gets a reminder of their own personal stake in U.S. energy policy every time they gas up the car. And it's not only high prices. It's also knowing that most of the oil consumed here is imported and the supply of oil that is produced in America is diminishing. This hour, we want to look at one specific aspect of energy policy. That is the push to open up parts of the U.S. coastline for offshore drilling. It would mean ending a moratorium that's been in place for over 20 years, and it would mean that oil companies would want a vast amount of seismic testing to be done. And yet the people who watch energy policy say offshore drilling is as close to becoming a reality for parts of the coast as it ever has been. Senators from Florida have argued against it, and it seems they've won their case. But that leaves great stretches of the east and the west coasts potentially open to testing and drilling. Simple question, is it time? I mean, with the cost of oil going up and domestic reserves going down, would you be willing to think again about allowing drilling off the coasts of the Carolinas, New England, or Washington State? Does the U.S. have to find its own new sources of oil? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to start today with Wes Allison. He's joining us on the line from the Capitol building in Washington. He's with the Washington Bureau of the St. Petersburg Times, and he's been covering this debate in the Senate. Wes, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What is all this about Florida as the one state getting a pass on offshore drilling? What's going on?
Well, Florida's got a long tradition of that. Those protections have been in place for more than 20 years, and it's kind of issue one for Florida politicians. So whenever any proposals start to filter through, they really hit it hard.
Now, you've got both a Democratic and a Republican senator representing Florida, and are they both equally opposed to the idea of offshore drilling?
They are. They say they are. Nelson's been involved, Senator Bill Nelson, the Democrat, has been involved for many years on this, and the Republican, Senator Mel Martinez, has joined him in the fight.
Now, what about the influence of the state itself, Governor Bush and state legislators? Is that important when we try to measure the opposition?
Well, you know, one of the things that of course, the governor's brother is the president of the United States, and in 2001, they brokered a deal to put a big section of the Gulf off limits to drilling, at least through 2007. So, yeah, that's helped a lot, actually. The Florida legislature's against any sort of drilling, despite whatever revenues it might bring to the state. Governor Bush has been solidly against it. So, you know, the connections to the White House there certainly have helped.
Now, the case that is made there, Wes, if I understand it, is based pretty well on the tourist industry, on protecting the tourist industry from the chance that something would go wrong with an offshore rig?
That's correct. Florida's got a $50 billion a year tourist industry, and of course, a lot of it is dependent upon the beaches. So the feeling is that it's just not worth the risk to allow drilling, even though the industry says that it's very clean, very safe, and that it spills very little.
Now, I understand the St. Petersburg Times did some work on this, went out to Galveston to look at the beaches there. What did your colleagues find, Wes?
Well, you know, they found junk. they found hard hats washed up and buckets and old tar balls, floating lumber. Now, of course, they do drill a lot closer there than they're talking about doing off Florida, but, you know, the pictures didn't look that good.
And tell me, when you hear this thing being debated in the Senate, are you also hearing other senators, say, from North Carolina or New England going, well, you know, we've got a fishing industry, we've got a tourist industry, or are you hearing a drift actually in favor of offshore drilling from some of the senators?
That's an interesting question. 80% of U.S. waters are off limits to drilling, and so most of the coastal states have these federal moratorium on drilling. Senator Landrieu from Louisiana is pushing an amendment to the energy bill that would give states a cut of the royalties that oil and gas companies pay to the federal government when they drill. The idea behind that is that with the prospect of getting, say, billions of dollars more a year from these royalties, states may themselves say, hey, maybe it's time we open up our waters. So Virginia right now, the General Assembly there has said, hey, we're interested in opening up the Virginia coast to drilling. Governor Warner there has blocked it for now, but it seems to be on the way. So, you don't have that sort of eagerness by, say, California or Oregon or Washington State or New York or New Jersey or North Carolina. But the idea is that if they can provide some, the oil pro oil drilling folks say that if we can provide some incentives, maybe we'll get a few more states to jump on.
So if Louisiana actually makes an arrangement where they get a much larger share of the revenue by allowing offshore drilling closer to the state, then you'll have other state politicians going, whoa, we should take a second look at this.
Yeah, we could use the money for education or roads or, you know, what have you, Medicare, Medicaid.
Wes, thank you for this. We're going to follow it, and I appreciate your help with it.
Absolutely. Have a good day. Thanks for having me.
All right, Wes Allison, Wes with the Washington Bureau of the St. Petersburg Times. I'm going to introduce my other two guests for the hour now. Debbie Boger is joining us. She is Deputy Legislative Director of the Sierra Club, and Lee Fuller is Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Petroleum Association of America, and they're sitting together in a studio in Washington. Thanks a lot, both of you, for coming in.
Thanks for having us, Dick.
Glad to be here.
Debbie, let me start with you. I'm wondering if you're seeing a sort of unprecedented level of interest and political pressure to get offshore drilling back on the agenda in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And unfortunately, you're right. There is kind of an unprecedented, attempts on a number of fronts by the oil and gas industry to open up different areas of our country that have historically been off limits to oil and gas drilling. Just to put this in perspective, we have just over the last year seen efforts in both the House and the Senate to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for drilling, which is a pristine refuge up in the up in Alaska that we believe very strongly should stay off limits to oil and gas drilling.
Although people
you
in Alaska like that.
I'm sorry?
People in Alaska, though, support the idea. They see some money coming to the state as a way of opening up ANWR.
Some do, but there are local peoples that, including the Gwich'in tribe, who are very, very opposed to drilling in the area that they see as very sacred. You also see record applications for permits for oil and gas drilling in the Rocky Mountain West. And now we see this effort to open up our coastline. So, you know, from our perspective, this is kind of saying that there are no places that are off limits to drilling. And from our perspective, we really think that there are places that are too special to drill, that are valuable to our children and are absolutely necessary to keep clean and to keep protected from the damaging effects of oil and gas drilling.
You're saying the moratorium that is in place now should remain in place, period.
Very definitely. We strongly support keeping the moratorium that's in place now in place for the future.
Lee Fuller, from the perspective of the Independent Petroleum Association, are you seeing public interest in changing the moratorium rules? Are you hearing from your own members an interest and eagerness to get some drilling started off the coastlines?
Well, we've been active off the coastline in the western and central Gulf of Mexico for decades.
Right.
That area has been open for drilling, and it has been developed quite extensively. It supplies about 30% of our domestic oil production and about 25% of our domestic natural gas production. And it's been a success story, both from a production standpoint and from an environmental standpoint. We do manage to get those resources into the domestic market very effectively. Certainly, we believe that the moratoria that have been in place for several decades now in the eastern Gulf of Mexico and elsewhere are mistaken policy, that this resource can be developed and can be developed to the advantage of the entire country. What we're seeing change from the past, where we've been the only people talking about that, is a stronger level of interest among the end users of natural gas, principally. Farmers who rely on natural gas to manufacture fertilizer, chemical companies that need natural gas for their processing operations, manufacturing companies that need natural gas for both their power source as well as product. And ones that are facing significant employment challenges right now because of the high natural gas price.
But are you saying that people who have been in the past opposed to opening up this moratorium, Lee, are now taking a second look and thinking maybe we need to get at this oil and gas?
I don't think that that those people that have been rock hard opposed to it are shifting extensively, but I think those people who haven't paid much attention to it in the past are now looking at it, recognizing the energy challenges that we have in the country. I think one of the other things that ought to be stated early on in this process is the discussion that we're having now about offshore development is focused on natural gas. It's not focused on oil. And natural gas is a different commodity than oil. It obviously is one that is has very limited amounts of liquid associated with it, so that if there are risks, they're very different than what the historic type of characterizations of offshore drilling present.
We have a break coming up. I'm just going to slide a quick question here to Debbie on that. If we're talking about gas instead of oil, are you any more inclined to say go ahead and drill?
Well, I think there are a couple things important to realize about kind of the argument of natural gas versus oil. The first thing is that the short answer is no. And, you know, natural gas, for a variety of reasons, the exploration for it and the development of it are very damaging. The same technologies are used to explore for natural gas as are used to explore for oil. And for example,
let me stop you there, Debbie, because we have to take a break. Chance for me to remind our listeners that our number is 1-800-423-8255. We will be talking specifically about the exploration and the mapping of reserves when we come back after the break. But we'd like to just hear some general thoughts from you, Connection listeners, on whether or not you're any more inclined to say maybe it's time to take a look at what the reserves are, to open up more to offshore drilling, if it means lowering the dependency on foreign oil. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection as the Senate debates the energy bill in Washington. The debate goes on today. We're taking a look at one aspect of that, and that is a push to open up some of the east and west coastlines to offshore drilling, or at least to the kind of testing that might lead to the drilling. And interested in hearing from you if you are any more inclined to support such activity. There's been a moratorium in place for 23, 24 years that has prevented that kind of activity. Is it time to revise that? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. We're actually starting outside the U.S. in Canada's capital, Ottawa. And Brad's joining us from there. Hello, Brad.
Good morning.
What's your lesson from from Canada here?
Well, we supply an immense amount of energy to the United States. I think of myself as much as of an American as a Canadian because I live and own property in the U.S. As long as we continue to have the driving habits that we do and the energy consumption habits that we have, North America in general will always be a net importer of oil and fuel. We will never, ever produce enough to take care of ourselves.
And so you're saying that offshore drilling is a natural way to go?
I think it's a necessary way to go if we're going to continue to consume energy at the rate that we do. But whether we do it or whether we don't do it, it won't matter. We will always import energy into both of our countries. We will never be self-sufficient.
So if it doesn't make a difference, what's the argument in favor of it then?
Just continuing to drive the economy, create employment, and create wealth in both of our countries.
Debbie, let me hear just briefly from you. In Canada, particularly off the East Coast, there's been quite a rush in offshore drilling in recent years. A lot of that is a long, long way offshore, 90 miles, 150 miles offshore on the Grand Banks of Newfoundland is where a lot of that drilling is going on. Is the Sierra Club as opposed to that kind of deep water offshore drilling as you would be, say, for something that might be 20 miles off the shore of the Carolinas?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And if you'll allow me, I just want to pick up where your caller left off. And I actually think that he makes the exact argument for why we should not be looking to additional drilled oil and gas resources. The United States has about 4% of the world's population, yet we use about 25% of the oil in the world. And so that statistic says to us that there is no way that we can drill for oil or gas, quite frankly, our way out of our dependency. there are much, much better solutions that are staring us in the face, that we have kind of under our noses, that we have underutilized. For example, on the oil side, if we raised the fuel economy of our cars to 40 miles per gallon over the next 10 years, we could save more oil than we currently import from the Persian Gulf and than we could ever take out of the Arctic refuge combined. Similarly, on the natural gas side, there are solutions that we have available to us right now with current technology to make our appliances more efficient, to make our homes and our buildings more efficient, that could save so much more electricity and much more cheaply and much faster than turning to our special places like our coastlines or like the Rocky Mountain West to to drill for more oil and gas.
But so, my understanding, Debbie, is that the energy bill that we're talking about here is in fact already a mixed package of incentives for conservation as well as incentives to bump up drilling in some of the areas that you're talking about. I mean that it's already a bit of a mix. Is it an either or in your perspective?
No, and I think that it's important to understand that while some characterize the energy bill as a mix, it's very important to understand the political process. The Senate bill is actually better than the House version, but it doesn't do nearly enough. We have these very high gas and oil prices staring us in the face, and we're looking at a Senate version of the energy bill that does not do nearly enough for efficiency. The Senate version also, and the House version, have absolutely nothing in them currently. There will be an amendment offered, but nothing in them currently to bump up the amount of renewable energy that our utilities use, like wind energy and solar energy and geothermal. So we have these resources that are being vastly, vastly underutilized. And instead of looking to those solutions that are really 21st century solutions, we're looking back at the old technologies of drilling for oil and gas. So from our perspective, there are so much better ways to go that we should not be looking kind of backwards to these old technologies.
Lee Fuller, let's hear from you on this.
I don't think we have to get into a conflict over whether we should be looking at one technology or another. I think that if we want to have a growing economy and be able to meet the needs of the nation over time, all of these issues ought to be addressed in some form. But I think it's equally important to try to make ourselves as reliant as possible on our own resources. Let me just mention a couple of the points that Debbie raised. On the question about fuel economy standards, I did some research on this a while back, and I took what was projected to be the growth in demand for oil over the next 10 years and compared that against the standard if this new CAFE standard were to be implemented. And what you find at the end of it is that while you do reduce the consumption of oil by doing that, it essentially puts you back to where you are today, that the growth in oil demand is offset by that reduction, so that we still have an existing issue of dealing with how do we get our oil and natural gas. Virtually every analysis would show that around 65% of our domestic energy comes from oil or natural gas, and it essentially stays that way for a long period of time into generally as long as the estimates are made.
So are you saying that means the coastlines are going to have to be opened up, or that there are other ways of doing this?
Well, I think there's certain resources that are available, and the ones that have not been developed extensively so far are the coastal areas and the Intermountain West. And both of those are areas that can be developed, and they can be developed in a way that helps the national energy supply, and they can be done in a way that protects the environment. And I think we have to pursue that.
All right, let me stop.
I'm not
you
suggesting
there.
That we shouldn't be looking at wind or solar or efficiency at the same time, but I think we have to keep in mind that part of the balance here is going to be oil and gas. And
I'm going to stop you there, Bill. Or excuse me, Lee, because I want to get to a call from Amherst, Massachusetts. Kevin's joining us on the line from there. Hi. Hey, Kevin.
Hi, Dick.
What are you thinking?
I was a petroleum geologist in the 70s and 80s, working primarily in the Rockies, but also offshore in the Gulf and in the Appalachians. When I was in the Appalachians, it there were government incentives for drilling.
And there are new ones in this energy bill as well.
In the pricing. What happened was we drilled up a storm, built up a huge reserve of natural gas, and the utility companies broke the contracts, rejected the contracts, and imported the gas from Canada because it was cheaper than having to pay the incentivized price.
So are you saying that there is enough natural gas, there are enough pockets of natural gas that are known, that have been explored on land in the U.S., that should be exploited next? Is that the point?
I'd say probably that those pockets of gas have probably in the past 20 or 30 years been exploited and are being used now. During that time, there was a tremendous amount of exploration being done offshore. This was the Baltimore Canyon drilling period and things like that. And a lot of the exploration came up with nothing. Talking about drilling offshore is two or three steps ahead of the exploration. And a lot of that exploration's already been done and has ruled out tremendous areas of the offshore shelf.
Kevin, let me go back to Lee Fuller on that. Lee, how much is known about what is offshore on the, what do they call it, the outer continental shelf?
Well, there's a good deal known, but it's as I think the caller mentioned, a lot of this was work that was done back in the 1970s. Since the moratoria have been in place, there's been very little done to update that information. As well as during that time period, the techniques to be able to assess what's available have changed considerably. We have much more advanced technology using the advent of computers, personal computers in particular, and the power of computers to improve the ability to analyze data. We now look at three-dimensional seismic work and in some cases four-dimensional seismic work to be able to assess where potential reserve bases are. And that's actually improved our ability to find smaller resources many places on shore and then to develop them.
So the oil companies would like to go back and look at some of the areas that have already been tested, is that correct?
That's correct, because that information in the areas that are under moratoria in particular hasn't been updated for decades now. And if we're going to make national policy decisions on the basis of what the resource base looks like, we ought to have the best information on the resource base. That's the provision that's included in the current Senate Energy Bill, would be to update that inventory.
Debbie Boger, you have some concerns about this testing. What are they?
Yeah, I'd actually like to respond to Lee, because I'm not quite sure where we get the idea that these estimates haven't been updated. There was a December 2004 estimate that was done by the Minerals Management Service, and this is an independent government agency, that showed that 80% of the gas available off our shores on the outer continental shelf is actually already available for leasing. So this means that there is only 20%, according to this recent December 2004 MMS study, there is only 20% of potential gas that we could recover by opening up the current moratorium on the Atlantic coast, the Pacific coast, and in the Eastern Gulf. So that's one point I have, is kind of a question of cost benefit. You know, is it really worth our while to open up all of these very, very special coastlines for what may amount to only 20% of the available gas, when 80% of the natural gas that we have available in our coasts is already available for leasing? So that's the first point. And the second point is, Lee talked about this seismic technology that is used to do the inventories. When we talk about inventorying our resources, the natural gas off of our coastlines, it's very important to realize that we are not talking about someone sitting in a room at a computer doing theoretical modeling. What we're talking about are seismic technologies that where ships drag behind them huge arrays of air guns that explode at regular intervals. And these technologies have, this specific technology of the seismic inventory has been shown to harm fish that have internal organs called air bladders that they use to orient themselves vertically in the water. They've been shown to impact whales and potentially even be associated with beachings. And so, you know, there is a lot of real physical damage that is caused by these technologies. So, and that is what is called for in the current Senate version of the energy bill.
All right, Debbie, let me just step in here. We will talk more about that, but I want to make sure that our callers get a chance to join us. To Fayetteville, North Carolina, for a call from David. Hello, David.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling. What do you think?
I would like to see them drill in the Manteo Exploration Unit. They sold the rights, the federal government sold the rights in 81 to the oil companies to drill it, and then it got in that moratorium and got blocked. The oil companies have already put their money up and said they were willing to drill it. It would help us with jobs in this area. It would help us get off our dependence of foreign oil, and it would just generally help the economy.
David, what area are we talking about here for people who don't know this coastline? Where are we talking about?
45 miles due east of Cape Hatteras.
And what do they know about what is there, David?
The Manteo Exploration Unit was found, and the leases were sold by the federal government in 1981. There's blocks out there that Mobil, Marathon, Conoco, and Chevron paid to drill it. And then the moratorium went into effect, and the oil companies had to sue to get their money back. So the oil companies are willing to put their money up in 81. I'm sure there's oil out there, and we can get off of our dependence of help us get off of our dependence of foreign oil.
How much debate do you think there'd be in North Carolina if people started talking about offshore drilling there? Do you think your neighbors would agree with you that the jobs and the oil that's there to be found is worth the risk?
I think it's an uphill battle in North Carolina, but I think that if gas continues to rise, it'll start going towards drilling. I also want your audience to remember that plastic is made from petroleum, and without plastic, you can't insulate electric wires, so heat pumps are useless. Alternative energies, electric cars won't work because they've got to have grease for the wheels, oil for the gearboxes, plastic for the bodies and interior. You got to have petroleum.
I'm wondering, Debbie, as you listen to what David's saying from Fayetteville, if you're at all concerned from the perspective of the Sierra Club that there's this shift saying, you know what, we can't remain stuck on Saudi oil indefinitely.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And I think that it's very true to say that we need to do what we can, everything we can, to decrease our dependence. But the statistic I cited earlier, that we have, you know, only 4% of the population in the world, yet mm-hmm. we use about 25% of the oil, means that we've got to do we can't drill our way out of our dependence. And so what we need to be doing is looking at the demand side, saying that there are technologies that are very, very simple. Quite frankly, you know, if we just as a country made sure that the pressure in our tires was appropriate, we could actually save an extremely large amount of oil, in addition to setting fuel economy standards higher. So I think that, you know, your caller actually made a point that bears repeating, and that is that there are places like the Outer Banks in North Carolina, like Virginia Beach in Virginia, your early caller had talked about Virginia Beach, like George's Bank in Maine, that would be threatened if we actually said that we were going to go ahead and do either this seismic type of inventory that I was talking about before, or allowing states to decide for themselves if they would like to do drilling for oil or gas off of their coastlines.
Connection listeners, do you see this as a balance, as time to start to exploit more of the oil and gas resources that are off the coastlines of the U.S., as well as bumping up conservation? Everybody's paying more for gasoline. Is that a reason to revise the energy policy? Are you paying attention to what's going on with the debate over the energy bill in Washington? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. We know about the cost of gas going up at the pumps. We also know that domestic reserves are going down in the U.S. when we're talking about oil. Would you, as a result of all that, be willing to rethink the idea of offshore drilling, drilling off the coast of the Carolinas, New England, Washington State? 1-800-423-8255. Debbie Boger is with me. She is Deputy Legislative Director of the Sierra Club, and Lee Fuller is Vice President of Government Relations with the Independent Petroleum Association of America. We're going for our next call to Nashville, Tennessee. Sam's with us. Hi, Sam.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, it seems to me that the distinction drawn between domestic oil and foreign oil is a rather false distinction, a meaningless distinction for most Americans, because there's a global market in energy, in oil or gas, and so, you know, of course, it makes some difference to the company that exploits the resource, but I can't see that it makes really any difference at all to...
You mean it's going to be $55 a barrel if it comes from Mexico, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia,
or
Canada?
Exactly. Oil drilled in Anwar will likely be sold in East Asia, not in America. It's like, what's the difference? We have a dependence on oil. It's rather irrelevant whether it's dependence on foreign oil or domestic oil.
Let's hear from Lee Fuller on the case for greater domestic production. I mean, Lee, I understand that in some places in the U.S., it's in fact more expensive to go after U.S. oil than it is to simply buy it by the tanker load from the Saudis.
Oh, certainly. The advantage that the Saudis have had over the past many decades is that the nature of their geology produces oil at a relatively low cost, and so they make a great deal more money for it when they sell it. But we are dealing in a world market, but we're also seeing a world market that continues to grow for oil, and a lot of the biggest growth now has been in China and India as their economies are beginning to increase, which is the reason why we're seeing such a strong upward pressure on the price of oil.
Right, but one of your companies drilling in the U.S. is going to go for the best price. So if that means, I mean, I know it's kind of a false argument, but if that meant exporting the oil to India or China, the company would do that. That's business sense, right?
Well, that would be potentially, but our domestic oil is essentially consumed in the United States.
Right, I understand.
Even the Alaskan oil generally goes to the West Coast, overwhelmingly goes to the West Coast. I think there's a small amount that may go to Japan. But that oil, also understand that the oil that's being produced in Alaska now is diminishing. Mm-hmm. It used to be about 2 million barrels a day. Now it's below 1 million barrels a day. One of the factors that Anwar, if it were opened, would provide would be to probably get another 1 million barrels or so a day for a many-decade period to add to that reduction. From our standpoint, though, I mean, what we're trying to say here is that we're not going to be ever completely independent of foreign sources of oil or natural gas, but there are security issues, there are reasons why those issues ought to be considered when you look at the governments that we import our oil from, that the more that we can do in our own backyard allows us to have greater control over our own economy, and it's a part of a broad energy picture. I'm not suggesting, as I've said earlier, that there's only an oil and gas solution to the energy.
I don't think anybody's suggesting that we're hearing that from you either.
It's broad based. But a domestic supply is an important component of it.
Okay, but
we may have a smaller reserve base than Saudi Arabia, but we're still the third largest oil-producing country in the world.
Debbie, does Sam have a point here?
Yeah, I think you know, in response to your caller's point, in one sense, he's absolutely right. You know, the environmentally, oil is oil, and we are addicted to oil, whether it be domestic or foreign oil. And wherever it comes from, oil burned in our cars principally is one of the major sources of carbon dioxide emissions, which is the major global warming pollutant. So, you know, in that sense, we have to get off our addiction to oil, whether it's foreign or domestic. In another sense, though, this is really a national security issue. And I definitely agree with Lee. It has big impacts for our economy, but also our national security. There's obviously what I think are very clear disadvantages to being dependent upon oil that comes from nations that could potentially be politically unstable.
So are you saying that there is an argument for more domestic drilling?
Well, I think there is an argument for getting off our addiction to oil. And, you know, what we talked about before is there are choices that are staring us in the face that have a lot to do with political leadership. And, you know, the way that we think is the obvious near-term, much faster way to reduce our addiction to oil is by looking at things like fuel economy. And just speaking about, you know, political leadership, I think we have to look to political leaders who have the will to take us in the direction of making smart choices to reduce our addiction. We saw President Bush just yesterday call for the passage of the energy bill because he says, you know, we're staring at high gas prices in the face and we need to pass this energy bill. But it was very odd that the day before he released a statement of his administration's policy that actually oppose a provision in the energy bill to reduce our oil use by or our oil imports by 1 million barrels of oil a day. And so it really that is odd, to say the least. And it just points to the fact that there is a question of, you know, can we get leaders that have the political will to take us in the direction that really makes sense?
I want to go back to our callers, to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Tom's on the line. Hi, Tom. What are you thinking?
Well, Dick, you know, there's so many levels that offshore drilling and ANWR drilling are wrong. It's very hard to pick one. Global warming, of course, is one, inciting us to imperialistic wars to get and protect oil supplies in Iraq is another. But I want to talk about one that's very personal. I live in North Carolina, but I lived in Southern California for quite a while, and I have walked many times on the beaches of Santa Barbara. Santa Barbara has oil wells offshore. It is touted as an environmentally responsible oil drilling effort, and I can't tell you the number of times that I've walked on the beach of Santa Barbara and then come off the beach, come home, and had tar all over my feet. Now, if the gentleman in Fayetteville wants to see oil drilling off Cape Hatteras, he ought to be prepared to have oil, tar, on his feet when he walks the beautiful beaches of North Carolina. And that's the price North Carolina citizens will have to pay to have extra jobs in oil drilling off the coast.
Do you know, Tom, that that tar comes from those offshore wells? I mean, could it come from the freighter traffic that's a part of that coastline as well?
Well, it could come from the offloading of the oil onto tankers,
yeah,
which dock on long piers that go off the coast of California. But it's funny that I also lived in Malibu. And I never had oil on my feet there. I never had tar on my feet. I actually lived in Malibu and frequently went to Santa Barbara. It was always Santa Barbara where I got the tar all over my feet. Strange, isn't it?
Let's hear from Lee Fuller on this. 1969, Santa Barbara did have a blowout. About 100 miles of that California coastline was fouled by that, and that hangs over the industry. Certainly it's in the minds of the politicians in Florida. How do you make the defense that this kind of drilling isn't going to foul up the beaches, Lee?
Well, you've hit upon the point that we've been frustrated with for decades now, and that is that we're debating an issue as if it were still 1969. The event that you talk about, the Santa Barbara oil spill, was a mistake, and it was partly caused by the fact that they were using technology that wasn't even up to the standards of its day, and it resulted in a bad event. Now, since that time, the technology has become almost space age in its in the quality of the kind of controls that it has on it. For example, I think the Minerals Management Service has has data that shows that since 1980, there hasn't been a spill over 1,000 barrels from any offshore oil rig.
Even a spill of 1,000 barrels sounds like a big spill to me.
It sounds like a big spill, but my point is that there haven't been any that large. Certainly the one in California was much larger than that.
So when Tom talks about that tar, is that stuff that's still coming in from 1969?
I can't really speak to it specifically. Not only do you have offshore oil rigs and oil tankers, there's oil seeps, natural oil seeps, that exist out in that part of the world as well. National Ocean Futures Study was done a few years ago, it identified that far more oil comes from natural seeps than it does from oil wells. So we're dealing with managing issues as technologically capable as we can be, and we've been very successful on that.
Tom, are you still there? Are you listening?
Yeah, I'm there. I'm very disturbed by this myth of the perfection of technology. I don't know how many times your personal computer has crashed, but mine has. There are a number of technologies that are touted as being space age, and in fact, I don't see NASA doing too well either at this point. So this idea that technology is going to prevent disasters that was back in the dark ages in 69 and now we're in the new bright future, that is a bunch of public relations, and I don't buy it for a minute. I mean, the fact is, where there's oil drilling, there's oil seepage, there's loss of oil, eventually there's tar on the beaches, and the oil industry can't sell me that myth. It may try to sell it to the American people, but I don't buy it. If there's oil drilling off the coast of North Carolina, people are going to have to face up to the fact that their pristine white beaches are going to be marred, and once they're marred forever. There's no going back.
Lee Fuller, did you want to say anything to Tom here?
Oh, I doubt that I'm going to be able to convince Tom. I can say that, for example, when Hurricane Ivan went through the Gulf of Mexico, which was probably one of the more devastating hurricanes, that the oil industry managed to prevent any spills from any oil rigs or gas production operations in that event. I can say that if you look at the debate that we're dealing with now, we're not trying to talk about oil right now in terms of opening the offshore. Our first step is to try to look at what we can do for natural gas and prove the quality of the technology. There's always going to be trade-offs that we have to make here somehow. Let me give you an example. If you took all of the natural gas wells in the United States and tried to figure out how much surface space they contain, it would be something about the size of the Hawaiian island of Kauai. If you generate the same amount of energy through wind energy, one of the emerging technologies, it would take the surface area roughly equivalent to the states of Montana, Oregon, California, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Nebraska. So when we look at what our energy sources are going to be and how we're going to meet our future energy needs, we have to recognize that there are balances that have to be made.
And Debbie, let me just hear from you, if I can, on the kind of trade-offs that Lee is talking about here. Because we look at Anwar. Anwar went through. Anwar was vehemently opposed, and now there's something of a political change in the mindset or a corporate change in the mindset or a change in the American mindset that allows that to go through.
Well, and I think in answer to your question, your last caller really just so well pinpointed where I think the American mindset is. And I think, just to kind of follow up on that, it really is a mischaracterization of the current state of oil and gas technology to say that it is non-environmentally damaging. Just this morning, I turned on my computer and saw a report from 60 miles southeast of New Orleans, where there was an oil leak from a platform, and it was just 15 barrels. This isn't even kind of the 100 barrels, I think, that Lee had talked about earlier. But, the spill was blamed for killing at least 400 brown pelicans and oiling up 1,000 or more additional ones. And so, the technology that we have in place today is still harming wildlife. It's still harming marine habitat. And even if we try and make the distinction between oil and natural gas, we talked a little bit about the technologies used for natural gas exploration earlier mm-hmm. being extremely damaging to both the habitat and to fish and other populations.
All right.
So, and the final thing I'll say is that there really is right now nothing that prevents a company from exploring for natural gas, for example, and drilling a hole and being surprised by oil and going
after
that oil.
Except the moratorium when we're talking about offshore
drilling.
Well,
I'm sorry, right. The proposal to say that, you know, we're only looking for natural gas and these will be natural gas only leases. There's really, you know, nothing to make me believe that a company wouldn't, you know, potentially find oil and then go back for that oil.
Let's go to Fayetteville, North Carolina. Charlie's joining us on the line. Charlie, thanks for calling.
Hi, I'm Charlie, and my point of view is that we need to work very hard on weaning ourselves away from burning oil and natural gas, the fossil fuels. My point is that at the rate we're consuming them, the world will run out within my lifetime. And these chemicals are too valuable for us to burn them all off. A previous caller pointed out that plastics are made out of, and there are also some medicines. They're also constantly developing new uses for these hydrocarbons, and these are our best supply.
I'm wondering, Charlie, if you've had a chance to look at the sort of description of the energy bill that's being debated on Capitol Hill now, and if there's anything in that that's answering the kind of questions that you have.
Well, you know, we're our energy bill, from my point of view, is largely driven by the people who would like to make money from developing and selling these resources. And there's not nearly enough conservation and alternate material, alternate use development in it from my point of view. And I would like to see, you know, one of the reasons that we use so much gas and oil is that it's so cheap. And one of the reasons it's so cheap is that the full cost of using it is not borne by using it. We deal with the pollution aspect and with building the roads with general revenues. And
Charlie, I'm going to stop you there, and thank you for your call. We are out of time for the program. It's clear, though, from the range of opinions that we're hearing that people are, in fact, paying a little bit more attention to what's going on with the energy bill. I want to thank the two guests who are with us for the hour. Debbie Boger, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Dick.
Debbie is Deputy Legislative Director of the Sierra Club, and Lee Fuller, I thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you, Dick. I appreciate it.
Lee is Vice President of Government Relations with the Independent Petroleum Association of America. Earlier in the hour, we talked with Wes Allison, with the Washington Bureau of the St. Petersburg Times. And you can, in fact, go to and look at the energy bill on our website. We are at theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Sarah Baker, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, John Robinson, and Doug Sugarts, with help from Chris Angles, Addie Goss, and Maura Kelly. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.